the very places and communities that you've situated yourself in, that you work in, are not neutral places. Can you talk about your methodology and how your methodology has developed over the years?
Yeah, I think it's really changed quite a bit over time. I mean, I initially was interested in engaging with refugee communities in a way to try and see if there might be a manner in representing them that was other than the way in which they were offered to us in the mainstream media. And this was about a kind of link between my own family's heritage, between New York City and Kenya. And my kind of first major body of work was about the refugee communities in Eastern and Southern Africa. And I think that kind of, I'm very timid to speak about the notion of methodology in any way, because it implies a kind of knowing that I still at this point don't feel I've acquired. But I remember the kind of sense of first visiting those places and the kind of inability to go and make an image as it was expected of me, to immerse yourself in a place of thousands of people in, you know, in the Sudanese border, the Kenyan-Sudanese border at the time, and immediately distill that down to something essential. And I felt a real kind of anxiety, even foreboding about my abilities in that regard. And I kind of soon realized that actually what I wanted to do was explore things in a collaborative way, to in some way expand our vocabulary when we think about how African communities, refugee communities, were thought of, spoken about. And part of that, I think, was this idea of the vulnerability, realizing as I kept working that actually perhaps being vulnerable was a kind of advantage, because it implied that when you first meet a community or you first immerse yourself in a community, you're not already carrying with you a kind of preconceived notion of how you want to render them the other. And by virtue of that, you're also open to what the place and the people have to offer. So if anything, I mean, I could loosely say is a methodology has been to try over the years that I've been working to remain at the outset as open as possible and to consider that perhaps you have some tools that you can put to good advantage, but that you should at the same time remain aware of being open to what the place prompts you with. And that's varied greatly, you know, from the African camps in which I worked was, you know, I was really upset by the way in which those communities were brought to us in America, and this idea of a kind of hierarchical relationship wherein if I looked in the New York Times and saw, for instance, the Somali border, which incidentally one can do today the same way in which we would have 20 years ago, it was always this notion of a pity and by extension a kind of hierarchical relationship in which I am above that person. I assuage my guilt by giving money. The person offered to us is often on their own. It's kind of a victim of this aggressive world. And the images then I decided to make at the outset were very simple. You know, they were kind of about the notion that communities sustain themselves past that initial exodus and, let's say, media attention? And how does one begin to establish a stage or a platform whereby those people can speak directly to me as the photographer and to you as the viewer? So simple, but to my mind, so kind of essential and important. That's also been a kind of part of the methodology, was deferring, asking permission, and then collaborating, and in a way stepping back, ratcheting down your expectations or your projections onto a place.
I think that one of the things that I've always appreciated about the work too, and this is linked to some of the things that you're saying right now, is just the temporality of the projects, you know, that people often think about photographers going somewhere, documenting, recording instantaneously what is taking place and providing you in the photograph an image of what's there. Mm-hmm. And I think that the way you've described this of not going there with preconceived notions, with certain assumptions, and allowing what you witness to start influencing how you think you can proceed, how you think you can begin to record the lives that are before you. One of the things that I've always liked, as I say, is the way that this takes time for you. You know, I mean, that you very often go live with the communities, you stay in the area for some time, and that it's not ever simply a matter of simply taking photographs, but you also accrue, along with the photographs, personal stories, personal narratives. You write your own texts. You interview them. You incorporate excerpts from the interviews. So it's almost as if the portraits, the pictures, are never themselves enough to convey what is taking place on the one hand. And on the other hand, the way in which, and we can maybe discuss this more later, but the way in which when you offer a portrait or a picture, it's almost as if you invite us by the way in which you contextualize these images in relation to one another, but also in relation to the excerpts, the text, and so on. You invite us to try and engage and hear and read what's not, let's say, strictly speaking, visible in the image.
Mm, absolutely.
Right? And that has something to do with understanding that when someone sees an image, having that image before you is not having that life or world before you. And could you say something about the way in which, let's say, the portrait or the image is never all there in some way?
Yeah, right from the outset, that the image, the portrait, is a kind of an invitation. Mm-hmm. And it does some things extremely well, perhaps, you know, better than moving images. It mm-hmm. establishes the invitation whereby perhaps the viewer would be open to the voice, mm-hmm. whether it be my own text, mm-hmm. but more importantly, the voice of the person that, mm-hmm. that is rendered in the image. Mm-hmm. And I've learned quite clearly that we all have the facade, but what we harbor within us is not always accessible. I'm also mindful of the fact that when I allow the voice, or when I offer the voice mm-hmm. forward in their own words, that can very quickly change the way in which you see their image. You don't, for instance, I speak about a group of images I made on the Somali border wherein the women had been assaulted by the Kenyan forces that had been sent to protect them. Mm-hmm. And at once the images were used to sort of change their position in the camps and help them in practical ways. But in another way, I was kind of concerned of the nature of the trespass, that somebody would be reduced to that one moment of mm-hmm. trauma in their lives. Mm-hmm. And this is something, I mean, in various ways, various refugee communities, there have been moments wherein I thought, oh, there are certain things that we don't need to know in a photograph, or certain mm-hmm. things that we need to protect. Mm-hmm. Conversely, there are certain moments wherein it is our obligation to bring something forward. Mm-hmm. So this specific example I offer you is one wherein I only realized some years later that in a way I had failed in my not having brought those stories forward. The women in Somali society, if they were assaulted, it's such a level of ostracism mm-hmm. that many of them had not only dealt with the trauma that had happened to them, had been cast out from their families, but also had sort of then moved beyond that. And the testimony was a kind of catharsis in the sense that they were declaring that this had happened, but that was not the totality of who they are as a human being. And I think now I've slightly made allowance for that possibility, mm-hmm. for realizing that there are some things it's necessary to bring forward and others which I can't access, should protect, or that the camera itself can't access. Mm-hmm. So you speak about the the images from Moksha, the town of widows, a place to which widows are migrating in northern India called Vrindavan when they lose their husbands. And in many traditional communities, the wife is seen as having been responsible for bringing the ill luck that caused the husband's death. And so often, just after the death, the wife is cast out of the home. Curiously enough, they turn to the very religion that is the cause of their plight, their predicament. So because of the religion, they've been cast out of the home, and they go to Vrindavan, where they believe that worshipping their Lord Krishna for the rest of their lives will give them moksha, or freedom from the cycle of death and rebirth. But some of these images, about which Eduardo has written wonderfully, are seen from behind, veiled. There's a kind of clear intimacy between myself and the subject of the photograph, I mean in the sense of proximity to her. But yet there's something, as we were considering earlier, there's something that you realize they retain, that the photograph doesn't trespass upon. Is it their link to their own sense of religiosity? Is it some sadness within them that can't be fully delved into or revealed in one single image? And I think that that allows for something to lay simmering and resonant when one looks at the image, because I think the image need not tell us everything. Mm-hmm. I think we need not be entitled to completely strip somebody down as they sit before us.
I mean, I think you know that's actually one of the elements of that particular project that I find so remarkable, right, is that you are regarded by many people as a human rights photographer. You are regarded as someone who tries to document and record the plight of dispossessed populations, refugees, etc. And so in that particular project, you want to presumably convey the plight of dispossessed widows. But the way the project is laid out in book form, and we've talked about this before, I mean, it begins in this book of portraits of widows. When you open it up, the first thing you see are these images drawn from the story of Krishna. And then you keep turning the pages and you get a series of blurry images of the entrance into Vrindavan. And then in this book of portraits of dispossessed widows, the first portrait of a widow is a portrait in which the widow is turned, has her back turned to the camera, and is completely veiled, so you can't see who she is. So there's this way in which, if you just track the way in which the project begins, there's a suggestion that if you want to see these widows, if you want to imagine that you would come to understand these widows, you have to pass through the history of Krishna, you have to pass through the history of the city, which isn't any city. But even then, you might not be able to see them directly. Mm-hmm. And I think that is so incredibly smart on the one, you know, because it's in a sense that you want to convey the plight, you want to show, you want to illustrate. And at the same time, there's a reflection within the project on the difficulty, if not impossibility, of showing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and by extension, you also don't want to exploit. I mean, I use that also in a similar way in Ramadan Moon, is that I'm interested in kind of honoring the belief system which has, you know, which they hold, that is, in essence, in Vrindavan in particular, is offering them solace. I mean, I felt this degree of sisterhood amongst the women, and that the Krishna is their father, husband, and son. So in some way, I wanted to try and express that solidarity, that solace. And it was also a little bit thinking about the way in which people had written and made images about that community was strictly about the exploitation of the women, which is you know, one component of what happens to them there. But I was more interested in it's not empowerment, but it was in kind of honoring their position, also their voice, to, you know, give them the chance to kind of put their case forward. And the book, in a way, is trying to do that. It's trying to as I said, to set a stage, and from that kind of immersion in the mood of the place, then to begin to look at these women and the stories of their lives.
And I actually think that and then I'll let Aaron say something, but I also think that that's one of the strengths of the project, because there's a way in which, for me, when I was thinking about the project and trying to write about it, the most difficult thing for me was exactly what you're saying, is that it's very difficult from a certain perspective to think of the women as something other than simply victims, right? In the sense that as you said, that they seek solace in the very thing that has produced part of their problem, right? But the way you set the narratives or the excerpts from the interviews with them became a way for me to measure their different relations to the religious context that has brought them there, right? So that some of them will say, I'm here, I've become a bride of Krishna, I've found solace, and so on. And another one says, I'm here. If my son told me that I could go home tomorrow, I would run home. and you get to see this kind of amazing variation in their relation to the story that has brought them there. And for me, that was extremely important to register. And I think it's exactly what you say, that it becomes a way of not seeing them only as victims.
Absolutely. I'm interested in, obviously I understand your work through the books that are right in front of me, but I'm interested in the other ways that your images, your photographs have circulated, particularly in the communities that you have lived and worked in. Can you talk a bit about that? What I seemingly heard as you were talking before was that there's another circulation of these images. It's not just in the form of the book that's in front of me.
Yes, that's right. Well, I think perhaps it was precipitated by September 11th, actually. I thought, having worked extensively in Afghanistan and with a name like Fazlullahi Sheikh, when I came back to America, I was in Kenya at the time, soon after September 11th, I came back to a city that I grew up in, Manhattan, at a time when the World Trade Centers were being built. So I felt this terrible rift within me between the place that I grew up and where I have friends living and the place in which I'd worked for 2 years and experienced, you know, been given great, offered great hospitality. And it made me very sad to imagine that the very people that had endured these decades in exile were going to be actually the recipients of another round of aggression. This is a long way round of saying that the way in which I was viewed when I came back to my own home was clearly as a suspect. And that's something that I've had to learn over the years to integrate into my worldview, you know, to be more patient and understand that for the foreseeable future, somebody like me is going to be viewed as a threat. Now, the reason I mention this is that if I hadn't an outlet at that time in which to put my energy, I think I would have become really embittered by the turn of events. And I thought, actually, these books, these exhibitions, they're accessible to a kind of elite. An Afghanistan book, I don't know, it must have been $80. I mean, somebody in Afghanistan would, A, never see it, and B, certainly would never be able to afford it. And so I conceived of a kind of series of projects which would be, well, democratic and freely accessed outside traditional publishing practice. The first two incarnations were about Somali women and children, both in the Somali camps in Kenya and in the Netherlands. And following on that first series, I did a piece about Afghanistan. They were distributed widely to NGOs, arts institutions, libraries, universities. And at each stage, I kind of thought of different projects that were, they're all experiments. I mean, you know that from Slot. You try to carve out a means of working that is perhaps a little bit more progressive or a little bit more challenging, and you know that can fail in different ways. But I would like to imagine that it's possible, as with your platform, to offer a kind of invitation that isn't about commerce, but is rather about the issues with which I was and continue to grapple. So I like the notion of confronting projects on these various levels, making them accessible, and also being, you know, pleased that they're able to be shown in museums and have another incarnation as a published book and the like.
Perhaps this is a naive question, but so are you often introduced through your images to others? When I look at these images, I see them, perhaps it's my projection onto them, but I see them as kind of testaments to a certain kinship or a certain relationship with the subject.
Mm-hmm. What does that mean? How would you describe what you think of that? I think that's probably right, but mm-hmm. it could be in various levels.
It seems that there's a relationship that over time, as Eduardo mentioned before, seems like there's a relationship that has emerged with the individual that mm-hmm. you are trying to in a kind of give a certain dignity to through this act of portraiture, or at least not undermine their sense of dignity. And so I'm interested in how that relationship emerges. Is it just a casual encounter that leads to that act of portraiture? I'm just interested, maybe in a slightly reductive way. Like, how does that relationship emerge?
It's a fairly slow plotting process, and I think if you make an image that you hope is compelling, you want it to be in the service of the thing about which you mm-hmm. you care. Not everybody feels that way, but I think that if I'm going to give my time to something, often I've chosen subjects that are sort of not often represented or have faded from view. In the case of Afghanistan, it was often I'm looking for a ray of my heritage, you know. And so in that case, I was looking for the legacy left by my grandfather, his name Sheikh Fadl Ilahi. So there's that level. There's the level of kind of exploring your past or your relationship. Perhaps you don't even know what parts of your personality are demonstrative of the link to that place. But very slowly and very deliberately. Although the first projects were about my heritage, Kenya was the land where my father was born, and North India, what became Pakistan on the Afghan border, is the land where my grandfather was born. After that, when I traveled to India more broadly, it's not as clear the connection. I think my choices betray a kind of affinity on another level, on a kind of a level of... it's difficult to use words to describe what that means, but of a kind of profound emotional experience in one's life. If you've endured or you've passed through that, perhaps you feel more connected to others who have gone through a similar encounter in their lives. I'm being a bit vague. I wish I could be clearer about that, but I think that my choices are very specific and clearly linked as well to a kind of personal narrative or less clearly a kind of affinity which is born of something maybe kind of inexplicable, emotional, psychological. One thing I'm really clear about is that when I choose the subjects which I choose, it's quite clear to me that those are the places in which I should be working. Vrindavan was a place where, very few people have ever even heard of the place, but something obviously drew me to that spot. And I think that also is what Eduardo and I were speaking about earlier, is that not only do you gather these, in your case, Eduardo, these images to a place and then begin in that isolation to figure out a kind of relationship between images and how you feel about them. That's one of the great gifts of having Eduardo write about my work, is that he uses that as a jumping off point for his own creative kind of investigation. And
can I ask you a slightly different question?
Yeah, sure.
precarity, like precariousness.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever photographed a community or an individual who wasn't marked in a certain sense by that condition of precarity? It seems like this is kind of something that one could think of as emblematic of your practice,
mm-hmm.
of the work of those that you've worked with,
mm-hmm.
and imaged.
I think there was a time when I might have felt somewhat apologetic about my level of privilege. I mean, we speak here at Princeton University. I've been very privileged in my upbringing to have the opportunity to, you know, study in great institutions. And I sort of always had the sense that then you are sort of obliged, if you have that degree of permission, to use it to advantage. And so I have absolutely always, or for the most part, chosen the things wherein, as I mentioned before, you know, if I make something that I hope is compelling or an invitation, I hope it's in the service of the thing about which I'm caring. So, I mean, I work on some projects more recently that aren't about that, specifically the notion of charity, but yes, I mean, that's...
Yeah,
it's a deliberate it's clearly a deliberate decision.
I didn't even intend for it to sound like an accusation.
No, it does. I don't take it that way.
There's an extraordinary sensitivity, it seems, that you have and your work has to the vulnerability,
mm-hmm.
Of those that, as Eduardo has written, are human, but not necessarily in a position always to have human rights.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I really do hope that that's a unifying undercurrent in my work, you know, that there is some kind of sensibility that's woven across the various projects. And when one looks at them, I hope there is, you know, it is apparent that that the tools are being used in a way that is empowering, you know. But, I mean, it would be said, and it was said of the earlier work, you know, oh, you make them look beautiful.
I was just going to ask that question.
And it's actually, mm-hmm. it's not something I believe to be possible. I think if you do anything, you strip away a little bit of your bravado, and you perhaps, at the best, you encourage an atmosphere wherein somebody offers what is already inherently theirs. You know, and it just, I mean, it's just kind of shocking to me that that's not really apparent to people when they work in places such as that. I mean, it seems like such a basic, to me, it's very basic. You know, it's not contrived in the sense it's the way I feel most comfortable being in any place, being here with you or being in a refugee community. It's just obvious that the degree of respect we would accord one another here is that which I should accord somebody in a refugee camp. And that's not taught to us. You know, that my first work in the refugee camps was always with the UN, High Commission for Refugees. And they always said, by virtue of their willingness to introduce you to a place, that was all you needed. You needn't go to the community directly, which was also a really fundamental question of mine, is how can you, at a moment's notice, insinuate yourself into a situation, into a community, without the very simple act of asking their willingness and consent. And so that became very clear in all the places in which I've worked, is this deferring. It's often a deferring.
I'm glad you brought this up, because there has never been an instance when I have spoken about your work publicly, when at some point someone in the audience doesn't ask about the beauty of your images and whether or not I think you have aestheticized your
mm-hmm.
subject,
mm-hmm.
you know, and which seems a very easy kind of accusation. And
mm-hmm.
I've always, so I mean, one of the things I had thought about was asking, and you've already gone a long way toward answering, it was just, do you think about the role and place of beauty in your work? Is it something that you think about? Is it something that you seek to mobilize in your effort to move viewers? And is it nearly inevitable in the way in which you practice your craft to produce these images in that way for a particular purpose?
Well, there's a commonly held notion that if you're speaking about a gritty issue, you should make a gritty rendering, which is something I never understood. I mean, in one way, I don't move through, I've never felt comfortable moving through the communities and photographing in a kind of surreptitious fashion. So as I've decided to make kind of formal portraits, I've never seen any impropriety in the idea of offering something in the best way possible, because I'm asking you to look at the person that I'm offering you, and beauty, if let's use that word. Let's say I couldn't look at many of my images and say they're beautiful, but I would say that I'm happy to use whatever arsenal I have to create the most empowering image possible. And in that regard, I would say that, you know, if we talk about those early images in the Ethiopian... sorry, one second. I want to turn this off because it's yours. If we talk about the earlier images in the African refugee camps, some of the images I actually didn't realize to be strong until much later, because you're so affected by the experience of being in place, and your access to the image is affected by what you were experiencing there. And soon thereafter, I realized, oh, actually, what was interesting to me was the way in which, when it was groups of people, they were deferring to one another visually. It means that they were emboldened or offering solace or somehow bolstering one another as a community that was enduring. And that's something, I mean, there are a couple of images which I look to as instructive for me, because it was suddenly this realization that there was beauty that they were giving to the process or to one another. People who've never been photographed before choose to defer their rendering, let's say, to the person in the image who's in a more desperate situation. It can be a gesture, it can be a gaze, and I think that's kind of extraordinary to witness. And it has partly also to do with this idea of denying this hierarchical relationship. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure what my images are always doing. I mean, I think they don't muster kind of financial commitments to place in the same way as other images do. Mm-hmm. But when that notion of pity is taken out of the discussion, mm-hmm. it then makes us perhaps consider a world wherein we could be in that mm-hmm. same situation, given just the fragile little line that divides us from them. That was something that we saw mm-hmm. Rwanda and Bosnia. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, oh, Africans, they're capable of genocide. You know, they're black folks. But then when it came to Bosnia, white, mm-hmm. broadly European, that was a shock, mm-hmm. you know? And that's what I'm kind of interested in. You don't know the tangible impact mm-hmm. of the images, but you know somehow that it's about raising a discussion and it's about subtly trying to shift one's view of another community, of the other. Mm-hmm.
In regard to that, since you have talked already about the way in which you learned very early not to enter a situation with certain presuppositions, assumptions, can you say something about the current project that you're working on in Israel and the West Bank, and what has been most surprising to you, what you have encountered that you didn't expect to encounter?
Yeah, it's a fascinating place and project. In a way, I was invited as part of a group of 12 photographers, and we were offered the opportunity to spend up to 6 months living in Israel, and we were afforded a real entree to the community. And at the outset, I was concerned. I mean, I was worried about the notion of being instrumentalized. I was worried about also, frankly, the academic boycott of Israel. But I realized as well that this was an opportunity, a chance to kind of immerse myself and to begin to try and figure things out, a kind of permission that I never otherwise would have. So I traveled and have in the last 6 months spent much of my time there. Initially, I was interested in the idea of working within the seam, the intersection between the Palestinian community and the Israeli community. And I interviewed combatants on both sides of the equation at the start of the country in 48, both on the Israeli side of the divide and the Arab side of the divide. Interestingly enough, many of the Israelis spoke Arabic because in their childhood they were living next door to Arabs. And soon what came up was this idea of the moment of trauma of the evacuation from those more than 300 villages of the Palestinians. And I started to visit them. Kind of often they were attributed to other time periods or they've been subsumed within forests. And in visiting them, I started to imagine and question, you know, who were the people who lived in this space? And so I started to make these journeys into the West Bank to find the people who had been evacuated. They were 80, 90, upwards of 100 years old in some cases. Mm-hmm. And the odd thing there is that people like myself have this degree of permission to move between one community and the next. So I can go from Israel to the West Bank, something that my Israeli assistants couldn't readily do, and conversely from the Palestinian side back to the Israeli side. I could go from the site of evacuation to the gentleman who told me about his memory or dream of the place from 63 years ago. And so we, as the artists, or I as the artist, became a kind of conduit between the following this memory trace from where this person once lived to a spot that is slowly, as they are, fading away, dying away, being subsumed. This was one component which spoke kind of directly about a difficult time in the history of the Israeli state. Mm-hmm. But also, I thought, you know, as a means by which to move past this extraordinary divide between the two is just to accept that some difficult things happened in the past. Mm-hmm. And the simple act maybe of acknowledging that would go a long way. Mm-hmm. The second part of that project was considering the contemporary situation within southern Israel, the Negev, whereby the area is slowly being consolidated and the Bedouin are moved off of their traditional lands into townships. And there I was curious to find actually that the forests which were being planted atop these recently demolished villages, it was like what I was seeing in other parts of the country. In 20 years from now, I would be visiting what they say that making the desert bloom. I would see a forest, but what would I be able to access? It connects a little bit to what we were talking about in relationship to the portraits made. What is it that is harbored, simmering beneath the surface which the eye can't access? And that's something that really fascinated me. So I began flying above the land, looking at the areas wherein places were being leveled and then planted atop. And I think it's been perhaps the most difficult place to work of any of all the countries I've worked in. Fascinating and divisive and but an extremely educative experience in the sense of realizing that context is such an important factor in the way in which one sees the history and future of that region.
Clearly you work through the questions and the tensions that you're trying to negotiate through your work. Like, your work is the means by which you think about and negotiate these larger issues. So, like, when does a project... it's not that it would reach a certain completion, but, like at what point do you move on? Or how do you understand when a process has reached a conclusion, given that these are issues and geographies and communities that, which face, let's say, problems and tensions that do not get concluded?
Mm-hmm. That's a very good question. I mean, it's a kind of an arbitrary stopping point after a time when you think you have material to articulate one kind of, to distill it down to one statement about a place, and that involves, you know, traveling to a place and back many times. But for instance, you know, and if I'm think about the Somali border, I mean, this is a community that has sustained itself for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I went in the early 90s and photographed there, and then I went back again in 2000. Mm-hmm. And tried to find some of the same people who had been in the feeding centers, this idea of continuity or this mm-hmm. phenomenal sense. I mean, we'd moved away from even considering that place, but these people mm-hmm. were, you know, were being raised in that community. Mm-hmm. Now, this year, it's 20 years, and I'm going back again to try and find out what happened to that group, mm-hmm. and to see now the number in the camps is three times what it was 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So the idea or the opportunity to re-engage with projects is also really interesting.
So the books are deceptive in the sense that they bring a closure.
They're deceptive in all sorts of ways. Yeah, I mean, I think you find a moment at which you pause, and it's sort of like the best you can do at that time mm-hmm. from what you have. You know, and I feel that way really strongly, for instance, about Afghanistan, mm-hmm. where I went with a kind of dual purpose, was to search for something that was very personal, was this, as I mentioned, the legacy left me by my grandfather. But I also found this refugee community, and the work is a kind of meditation on those two investigations or interactions, right? But soon after 2000, September 11th, you know, thinking about going back, I frankly don't know what I would say different about that place. Very sad to admit, but I sort of thought it's another cycle of mm-hmm. exploitation and violence, which I don't know how to muster a different sensibility to engage. And, you know, as an extension of that, I would say, well, I wish my country would think a little bit more clearly about the ramifications of simply going into a country because it suits our needs and then abandoning it. Yeah, but I think there are moments at which one can imagine revisiting mm-hmm. because you can follow a strain of the work onward to a new destination. And there are other moments when it's kind of reached its closure in that concise moment of investigation.
Mm-hmm. And at that moment that I think that what's emerging in the work is a cosmopolitanism that would cross the national, I mean, at least through your practices, you would enable us to think, and Eduardo, I think, has written about this, some would at least to imagine a different form of belonging, even if most would not be able to experience that. You consistently invoke kind of my country and kind of...
Well, it's interesting because I have a degree of permission. In Kenya, they call me Point Fife because you're half American and half, as they would say, from there. But I'm actually half sort of, or mm-hmm. in different ways, from many places, which always makes me alien. At the same time, I feel it gives me a degree of permission to connect mm-hmm. on some level to various places. Mm-hmm. And I think we haven't talked about that much, but I remember in the early 90s when I was working in these Kenyan camps and how it was always said that I was a son of a Kenyan father and American mother. Mm-hmm. And it was strictly speaking true. And I didn't think about it in such critical terms at that moment. But now I realize that there's something kind of divisive about that. Mm-hmm. Firstly, my father was Kenyan of Indian descent, mm-hmm. and bore no relation to the five communities in which I worked that were culturally, religiously, linguistically distinct one from the next. So, but what was it? Why was it that somebody would write such a thing always right at the outset of an article about the work? It was a kind of opening of a permission, like, because this person is a member of that mm-hmm. that community, he has the right to speak, and this stage that we've given on him, we can look through that, one might even say in a voyeuristic sense, to that community. And that's something that more recently is a little bit troubling me, because I think that this divisive quality is often used, you know, and that seems to be more and more the case in contemporary art and culture, is a kind of forbidding one to go across, to reach across boundaries. Okay, a lot of my work is indeed about my heritage, so it's a double-edged sword in that sense. But you know, we'd say visually the most compelling book made ever about America was by a foreigner, by Robert Frank. Mm-hmm. But of course, he was white, so perhaps you don't worry about that notion of trespass. Right. But as I would define myself as a person of color, mm-hmm. and I would say, you know, that I, in my work at least, I'm insisting upon the necessity of reaching across cultures mm-hmm. and boundaries to offer a kind of openness. In some of these, I mean, a few of the projects were specifically about women, because I thought, oh, here was another thing. I'd love to make a body of work, actually, when one sees it, they would imagine that it was made by a woman. Because mm-hmm. you're also sort of traversing a kind of potential gender divide. Yeah, so I'm pleased if that's something that you mm-hmm. that you imagine when looking at the images.